Hello, and welcome to recording number 17 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. I'm going to restart here on page 121, paragraph 4. Having nothing specific to do during the fair did not keep Gord from enjoying himself. In fact, he thought it a great joke, stealing from the thieves of Porna. The weeks of fair time passed swiftly, and although he had little teaching during this time, Gord managed to pick up some skills just by watching, for he was already quite accomplished at climbing and balancing, prerequisites for successful thievery of the more subtle sort. Thus encouraged, he spent more time in town and devised a scheme he was certain would reap dividends. He again posed as a rich, somewhat foolish young fop. He allowed himself to be set up for a swindling operation that the Caporna thieves put into action, thinking him an easy mark. He had passed himself off as a connoisseur of art and a collector of statuettes and objects of similar nature. He was tested with the offer of a dubious piece, as he knew he would be, and dashed the hopes of the swindlers, who had been expecting an easy profit by disdainfully rejecting the valuable item. Then, as Gord had also anticipated, the swindlers tried to get the better of him with the old bait-and-switch routine. The thieves took him to an exclusive shop, which Gord recognized immediately as a phony setup filled with goods from the storehouses of the thieves, and whatever fence was also in on this scam. Gord readily waxed enthusiastic over several of the splendid pieces they had, but then he was hustled out. No sense in making a hasty purchase, or so his friends recommended. They promised to meet him again the next day, and they would return to the warehouse to make final decisions, by which time Gord knew cheap duplicates would be ready to pack in boxes. But there was no waiting till the morrow. That night Gord entered the shop from the roof, aided by several of his new gypsy friends. He regretted having to kill a guard, but that was part of the business. Gord stayed out of Caporna altogether after that night, and he appeared only as a Renee man when he went anywhere beyond the gypsies' camp. The gypsy train that left at the end of the great fair held far more wealth in its wagons than anyone would have expected, and Gord, the one the acrobats had to thank for this new affluence, rode along as their leader's right-hand man. Well, Gord is back in, we're in Caporna, which is this town in the northern bend, and, you know, somewhat removed from their Tonsmi, where they have a fair every reaping. And then, obviously, one of the things we find out then that there is an organized group of thieves within the city. And that kind of says, like, I think almost any city you're liable to come across, there is going to be some form of organized crime, some a thieves guild or some kind of, you know, just, again, it seems to be a widespread thing that the cities in the Greyhawk campaign, in the Flaness, they seem to always have their thieves and their fences. Now, Caporna is only supposed to be about 6,000 population of the town, and then 12,000 during this fair time. So it is interesting that, you know, even a relatively small city or very large town would have their organized thieves guild. Again, this is a kind of an extraordinary little city because of that business with the fair and having to bring in, you know, double its population. And in this area, bringing in 6,000 people to come to that town during their fair time month. Now, we learn a little more about Gord here. Now, he's at the point where he had rarely actually fought or fought to kill, although I'm not sure when he was back in the Thieves Guild Beggar War. He did fight in those months and kill several thieves, and he also fought to survive. So, you know, he was used to, at a very young age back then, of having to fight and kill. But still, Gord has, you know, he shows that he's not just as cynical as he says he is, because here he regrets having to kill the guard and not simply taking it as, you know, the most expedient step. That really, it's kind of better behavior than we see with most of the people he encounters, who among the Rene and the citizens that he's encountered in the city of Greyhawk, that life and death are very, you know, they're easy matters, that it's not something that most people would hesitate to do. Life is very cheap in these big cities. We have a little bit here of what you could do. It doesn't really give you much about Caporna here, as far as like working out what the streets are like. But it does give you an idea of a little adventure you can have in this small city, what the fair time would probably bring in. Now, Gord has dressed himself up as a Rene, but it may be that he's dressed up as an Atloy, and they just aren't referring to them exactly. But the wagon-born Rene, the wagon-born gypsies, are being called Atloy, and the bargemen are normally the, you know, the folk. And I would think that it would be a little rare to encounter the bargeman Rene in a city like Caporna that is removed, you know, looks to be removed from the river areas. And it's, you know, mentioned that these Atloy, who are horsemen and horse traders, that they've come overland to this city, and it does look removed from the kind of large rivers that the Rene would, boat bargemen would be plying up and down. All right, that was the end of chapter 12. I'm going to restart here at chapter 13, page 123, paragraph 1. As the horseman's steed topped a low rise and galloped into a clearing bathed in moonlight, several quarrels buzzed and hummed past Mountain Rider. The man crouched lower, and his horse seemed to jump ahead with a burst of new speed. In seconds, they were lost in the thick shadows of the trees beyond. A dozen steel-capped warriors followed the fleeing rider through the moonlit meadow, and likewise disappeared in the darkness beyond. And the pounding of hooves faded into the night, and the place was peaceful again. Insects resumed their course, and the rustling of small animals, making their nocturnal rounds, could be heard by a careful listener. Nearby, a giant owl voiced its deep, mournful hooting. A moment later, the shrill cry of captured prey split the serenity for an instant. Fortunately for Gord, he was not being hunted by such sure predators as the denizens of the forest were, and he managed to elude his pursuers in the dense woodlands. Both he and his stallion were very tired, but Gord knew they must press on through most of the night, so that when the sun rose, those tracking him would not find their quarry nearby. Dismounted, careful to be as silent as possible, the young outlaw led his steed southwest, going ever deeper into the heart of the Netherwood. Break. All right. You know, so here we have Gord being pursued by, several warriors, steel-capped warriors. Now, what it, at first it's through a moonlit meadow. Now, when he reaches the forest, I'm glad to see that Gygax mentions here that Gord is leading the horse, because forest riding, especially at nighttime, unless somebody has, you know, the horse is not going to have infravision or ultravision or being able to see at night, is extraordinarily dangerous. And especially in a dense forest where it's not, you know, it's a wild forest and dense. So, you know, unless, because he mentions leading his horse, that makes very good sense. While those pursuers, if they're racing, they have to be following some kind of pathway. So if you're looking at a wilderness encounter, it's always good to look and see what the terrain is like. So, you know, if it's broken terrain, if it's densely wooded, if it's marshy terrain, you really have to consider it. It adds to the feel of the story to consider what that does to movement. So, you know, here there isn't much here, but it is very interesting. And we're told then that he is in the going to the heart of the Netherwood. And offhand, I see
that's not on that sure. map.
Oh, is it? Is it the
the one that I just posted? But the one in the book, it's all the way up by the pale.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah, so he was in Caporna, yes. And he was riding along with the chief as his like first mate or whatever in the last chapter, and in the period of a page, we're all the way close to the pale. So a lot has happened.
Yeah. So yeah. Well, it does not say at this point how much time has passed. Just that they spent the time, previously in Caporna, to the end of the end of the festival, and from there we're not really told how much time has passed between the end of chapter 12 and the beginning of chapter 13. We are given, like I said, at least at the end here, we're given a location of the Netherwood. I don't know offhand, what state is that located by?
I think it's in the Pale. It's hard to say. It's the bottom of the Frostwood between Stoink and the Pale.
All right. Okay. I see. Exactly. All right. That's the Netherwood down there. Okay. And then I'm not sure, but here he might be going further toward Stoink, because I believe, doesn't it say he's traveling, southwest?
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, both he and his stallion. Yeah. And his led his steed southwest. So he does seem to be going in possibly the direction of Stoink. So that may be the next place that he encounters. And then we see that the curving of the Artansame, is going right through that whole area right there, up and down. It's a very big curving rather. And in fact, Caporna was mentioned as being in this area called what I believe the Great Bend.
Right.
And so you can see that Great Bend probably refers to a bend in the river there of the Artansame, because there's several bends that are indicated.
Yeah, it meanders a lot.
Oh, yeah, especially on the more detailed map than it does on the, I believe the Darlene map doesn't show it as bending back and forth quite so much. But here we are getting quite a ways from the city of Greyhawk, and Gord is now beginning his travels across all of the Flaness. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 123, the final paragraph. Utilizing rocky ground, a small rivulet that fed into the Yol to the north, and every other device he could think of to throw off the soldiers who dogged him, Gord plodded onward. Sometime after midnight, he finally came to a dingle where he decided to camp. The stallion fell to grazing immediately as Gord unsaddled the tired animal and flopped down himself exhausted. He dozed until first light and then was up and moving again. Gord walked the horse until they found a place to drink. There he refreshed himself with a quick splash, ate a handful of iron rations, and topped his breakfast off with a bunch of the peppery watercress that grew in the stream. Feeling far better, he mounted and urged the stallion into a trot. Perhaps today he would finally lose his pursuers permanently. The troop of Chol soldiers chasing him were servants of his faithfulness, the Canon of Red Maud, a town of no particular note near the heartland of the Theocracy of the Pale. When Gord had left Red Maud, he had wanted simply to put as much distance between that place and himself as his courser could manage. He had not dreamed that the cannon would send his minions on so long a chase, for it was now nearly 2 weeks since his departure, and the soldiers were hounding him still. Gord wondered if their doggedness was because of the golden reliquary he had taken from the cleric's temple, or whether it was because of his familiarity with his faithfulness's daughter, Light. She had shown him a few things all right. No matter either way, whatever their motivation, the outcome would be the same if he were caught by the troop of avenging riders. Like, all right, you know, this is, you know, the Theocracy of the Pale. I've always gotten the feel that Pale is a particularly narrow-minded kind of place. You know, that you'd have this kind of thing where you'd have this structure, and obviously, the Canon of Redmon, he's holding a position where he's got, you know, bands of mounted soldiers. And it's a town of no particular note. So it's interesting that he's able to send off a troop of mounted soldiers to chase down Gord. Now, it's quite possible that the item that Gord has stolen may even be something of clerical magic, you know, so it may be much more important. Or it could just be simply that Gord's dalliance with the cannon's daughter, Light, you know, is something that has offended his honor, and that could be where those soldiers are sent out. It's good to see that Gygax again. You know, he's, if you you know, like most horses, you cannot just ride them for hours and hours and hours. Horses in the campaign are following what we know of real-world horses, unless there's something special mentioned about them. So if you were riding your horse, the way that you would normally do is you would, if you were riding it heavily, you would slow it to a trot, trot it for a while, get off, walk the horse, and then when you needed to rest the horse, you would dismount, and a good horseman would take care of the mount before he took care of himself. So the things that Gord should probably be doing, and he might have done but just not mentioned, would be not only unsaddling the horse, but wiping it down, making sure it actually had more food than what it could crop from the grass, and water, because if he is riding the horse hard, then it is going to be essential to keep it functioning. And big horses like a courser, they are they were in our world normally fairly delicate, in a sense, so you did have to take care of them. All right, I'm going to restart here. It is page 124 and it is paragraph 4. As he rode, Gord recalled the events of the past few months. From the Great Bend area, the gypsies had taken their horses southward. The train had passed slowly through County Erst during the month of Harvester, celebrated Brewfest at Trigot, then crossed the Franz River just above the city of Galesford. Autumn was spent moving on southward again, through the kingdom of Nyrond, past Woodwich, to the land between the Duntide River and the Celadon Forest, where they wintered near the town of Beetu. During this whole time, Gord had been given intensive training in the art of acrobatics, and soon he was tumbling, leaping, vaulting, and even walking the taut rope with the best of the apprentices. Of course, during the same period, he was in turn teaching his adopted family members the fine points of his own crafts, while the wagon folk were as able as their water-loving kin in performing minor pilferage and thievery. Gord was instructing them on a far higher level, and they were apt pupils. Break. Well, that's, you know, that's quite a bit of little, geographic information there. You know, we get, like I said, Caporna's in the Great Bend area. And then the Atloy are heading southward. And, you know, right there, they're gone into the county of Ernst, whose capital is Radagast City. It says here also that we get between the end of chapter 12 and the beginning of 13, where we see him being pursued, that several months have passed, and he actually starts naming them with Harvester and Brewfest. You know, Autumn was spent moving on southward. They go through Nyrond and Woodwich. Now, as I'm saying all this, there is also a text channel here that we have on Discord, and maps are being put up. And if anybody would like to comment, but not, you know, actually have to get recorded, they feel free to ask questions and type them up in the text, and you know, I'll do my best to answer anything that's put up in questions right here. Now, then we get to what's turned out to be a little interesting bit is about the city of Galesford, and something that isn't noted anywhere else.
Yeah, I couldn't find it on any map anywhere.
Now, I posted that on a section of the Cannon Fire website, and it was mentioned that the person replying felt that it was then turned out to be the town of that there was another town there.
There's another town called Ford.
No, but it's called, that the person who responded is very knowledgeable, said that he thought that on Anna's map, and that he himself felt that Galesford was the town of Kertulin, which was mentioned twice, once in the Living Greyhawk Gazette here on page 75, and the other in WGR 4, which I believe is the Marklands, on page 76. But there's no mention of Galesford in the LGG or WGR4. So, you know, that means that, you know, they could assume that, but it, because of maybe where those other later mentions are of that town are put in by Sergeant and then by, you know, Gary and Eric and Fred for the LGG. But it is of note that there's no other mention that it was Galesford. Now, if you look at the name, then we'd have to look. Now, this is something that has been brought up before, is that the names of these towns should have some meaning. So we have this town called Galesford, and it is the Franz River is just above the city of Galesford. Now, with a name like Ford, with Ford in it, right, it kind of implies that either the Franz River or some minor tributary should be an actual place where you can cross the river there.
There should be a river or a tributary called Gale, I would think, but
yeah, and it Well, it could be quite a it could have several meanings, like being Galesford. It could mean that there's particular storms in the area, gales. Although
Gale was his wife, too, right?
That's the true, but spelled differently.
Okay.
It's very hard to tell where he picked out that name, but if there is a name of a ford, then there should be, and it, the mention of the Franz River. Now, I don't know if the Franz River has fords rather than bridges over it, then it is not going to be easily navigable by larger barges and boats like that. It's just if a river is low enough in places for fords, then there's going to have to be some kind of, they're going to have an area where they can drag the barges across the ford, maybe it's only crossable by small boats. But it is a place then that could be like an end stop for barge travel or by, larger boat travel up and down the Franz River. And I'm not sure offhand how navigable the Franz River has been, meant to be.
I saw a place called Dossel Ford right up there by Thunder Keep, but
I don't know offhand if that is a later town or a Gygaxian. Now, one of the things we're going to be doing is that in the section of the Cannon Fire website that holds the archives of the recordings, there is going to be access to the Saga of Old City Index. And it will just have, instead of the big index that I had worked out, it will have an index just for the book. And so if you want to find things, and that's especially where if you want to find things in the book, but don't want to listen to hour after hour of the readings, then hopefully you can look at that and find out which recordings cover, this information, like which ones talk about the Rene and which ones talk about these various cities. And right here, that we're commenting on, this is the only mention of Galesford. And again, it's got a little idea, and it's in an interesting place. And as mentioned too, on the one map, that's why they're saying it is that other city, because it's shown on the other map that there is Trigo, then cross the Franz River. And there aren't that, it is interesting that there would be two cities right across from each other. And that is more of an implication than that the Franz would be hard to cross. And yet the name Galesford kind of leads you to think that there is a crossing right there. So it doesn't say that Trigo is on the Franz River, but it really should be.
Yeah, and the other city was Kertulin.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're right next to each other on the Franz, on either side of the Franz.
Yeah, and that first is mentioned by Carl Sargent in WGR4. And then again, that reference is used in the Living Greyhawk Gazetteer. And I would think that looking at that other map, that it really implies that the northern city is Trigo, and then the southern city is Galesford, which they've renamed, that sergeant renamed, for one reason or another. Now, I usually go, and this is not only Gygax, but this is the first TSR Greyhawk Adventures book. And so that what is in here is meant to be campaign-specific to the, the folio and the 83 box set. This should be very campaign specific for that. And obviously it's that they didn't know every little thing. So in a sense, that town, I don't think it's mentioned again of a town just south of Trigo, but here it has it by a different name. And I don't know if Sargent just didn't like the name You know, maybe he was familiar with the Gaelsford in England, or just didn't like the name. That name is a sergeantism. So, and I usually go with Gygax, you know, where it goes, unless it's something so, you know, out of place. Now, it's nice to get the listing of the months, and we do have them in various, you know, supplements that tell you what the months are. I think right from the folio, there's, you know, a calendar provided. We do get this idea then that autumn was spent moving from southward through Nyrond, past Wooditch, to the land of the Duntide and the Selaton, and then they end up wintering in Beetu. So from Gaelsford, it seems like we have the time from Brewfest to winter is spent in traveling. But, you know, there's no mention how much time is passing, because it seems like, again, that the Atloy take a more leisurely pace. They're not being driven by the, you know, the up and down the on the barges on water, and they don't have to. I think that it just, they're taking a much more leisurely pace. They have their horses to move, and they have the terrain to cover, which can be much more difficult than, you know, crossing these rivers by barge. And so Gord then explains the kind of stuff that Gord is learning. And I believe, I'm not sure if it was an actual alternate character class, but I believe that Gord is eventually like something like called a tumbler. Or a tumbler thief or something.
I think it's a thief acrobat, and I think it's thief in the Unearthed Arcana.
Okay, because, you know, he is developing this alternate skill system that isn't your classical thief. And then finally, when it mentions that he's teaching the Atloy the fine points of, you know, thievery, that what we have here then, performing, that they were only minor thieves of pilfering and thievery. And I would think that the far higher level is more about the, again, the disguise and planning out, you know, more subtle operations like he learned, you know, in Greyhawk. And a lot of that seemed to be about disguising himself and doing cons and swindles, and not necessarily the kind of thing that the Outloy would be particularly good at, who are mostly like horse traders and minor thieves and swindlers, because they are set on a path back and forth. That is, it's more locked in place, I guess, than they feel going up the coast would be with the barges. Or maybe they have more set territories. Like, as we saw, we had the Atloy from Radagast City who come all the way up to Caporna for the festival, but then he changes and goes off with another group of Atloy who are a little different than the Atloy he'd originally traveled with, you know, who were more about, like more a carnival group, with much more about performance and acrobatics and tumbling. So, you know, perhaps the Atloy could be seen as these tribes having territories, you know, these groups and caravans that had separate territories and really didn't, you know, like travel together, whereas the bargemen, the Rene bargemen, would group together, coming and going, and join up with, you know, bargemen who had stopped at areas and travel together in bigger groups. So, you know, I think that's something that is implied in the context right here.
It seems like each family has different places they have to, well, don't have to, but they want to be at particular times of the year for festivals or whatever obligations, at least with the Atloy, not necessarily the Rene. I don't know that we know enough about that yet.
Yes, the only thing that's mentioned with Rene previously is that they winter, that cove is one of the places they winter. So now we are moving further north, and but they are on the near Dev. So I don't think there's ever mention of a lot of freezing going on the near Dev in the winter, or any of these streams freezing over, you know, like the Valverdiva or the Artansame. I don't know if there's any mention that they get so that they'll get frozen over or choked, but they do talk about wintering on that cove. And here, then, we have the festival in Caporna, you know, in, I think it was reaping, and that would be, you know, time for, say, these interconnected Atloy caravans, as well as other merchants and people, to travel to that town, you know, for that particular time period. And from there, you know, why they're traveling in these other directions isn't really mentioned. But definitely that, you know, you could keep this down in your campaign as a regular event full of ideas for adventure. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 125, paragraph 2. At the end of Fireseek's chill, wagons began rolling northward again, making for the Flinty Hills, far distant. Before going on to Midmeadow for Growfest, from there to be bound for the annual fair at Radagast City. It was at Midmeadow that Gord parted company with the train, but not with all of his Rene friends. Two adventuresome young Rene accompanied him on a foray into the theocracy, the threesome bent on relieving the prosperous Palish of some of their material treasures. Break. All right, now here I am wrong. This group, it does end up going to Radagast City themselves. So they're making a circular journey here where they leave Caporna, where they've run into the other Atloy. And now Gord doesn't differentiate them. He's not calling them Atloy, but they are. Instead, they're just Rene. And so there's enough link between the two societies that they were accepting of Gord. And actually, the Atlois appear to be much more accepting of him. You know, it had been mentioned that that's two of the young Rene are going off with him, and, you know, up into the Pale. Now, we have a little direction and a time that even during the winter, they're on the roll and headed northward again. And then we have a caravan route. So we can take these various places, and there would be in the campaign, if not a roadway, at least a route that should be used, you know, over and over again, at least by the gypsy Atlois. And here we have again that they're in the winter, and they're going for the Flinty Hills and then Midmeadow for Growfest. And I guess, is Growfest like springtime? And there to the annual fair at Radagast City. So here again, we have another event that is going on, and, you know, where these, you know, where these traveling entertainers and horsemen and horse traders are traveling back to Radagast City. And it's going to be at these places, like Caporna, Radagast City, where the Rene kind of mix. And it's important for like a culture, for the members of it, even for a nomadic group, for their gatherings. And so here we have a place, that annual fair, where there are going to be Atloy, there are going to be the barge folk Rene. And so there we're going to have, if you're doing a Rene campaign, to keep an idea that this is where there'd be marriage into intergroup marriages, and, you know, where the people are going to, you know, like these two have left the caravan and gone off with Gord. Others may join the barge folk. Back when we were reading about the encounter with the sea monster, Miklos's barge lost three adult males. That was a huge chunk of the working men on that barge. That also included the old, the young, So where is he going to get the replacements from them? Maybe by marriage into people marrying into his, or other René who are relatives who have too many people on their barges, and they move off to other. So there's all this information that you can use to really flesh out the little bit that we know about the René. So here we can really gather up some ideas for campaigns. Now the final thing here is that we have the theocracy is known as being prosperous, and you can see that where even what they call the small town of Redmond ends up having a pretty strong force for that cannon to be able to use, and soldiers, and a golden chalice, which seeing the value of gold, that is that's quite something. I mean, gold is so valuable in this campaign that a golden chalice could be of very, very high value. And if it is in a smaller town, it's very interesting that there's the force of soldiers and the value of a golden chalice that can be stolen in the smaller areas. And here, so the theocracy of the Pale is a more prosperous area, probably, than the things that Gord has come across, like Lukesh and Radagast City. And, so that's the Duchy of Ernst and the County of Ernst. All right, I am going to restart right here. It's page 125, paragraph 3. The adventure had begun well enough. Equipped as they were with the finest mounts from the gypsy herd, the three were soon far away from Midmeadow and well into the Pale. Here they robbed an incautious merchant traveling a back road, there a wealthy tradesman. In the towns, they used more subtle arts to relieve their victims of excess coinage. And in such places, Gord and his fellows also utilized their acrobatic skills to perform daring feats of burglary. The Palish were not, however, much impressed with such applications of the profession of thievery, holding the activity in disrepute and giving no license to any association or guild that allowed such practice. Therefore, the trio stayed but a little time in any one place. All right, now, so far we've had the city of Greyhosh, Lukesh, Radagast City, and Caporna all having organized thieves, if not guilds of themselves, I believe that at least Lukesh and Radagast City also had thieves' guilds, and I think Caporna may have as well. And so you have now into the Pale something about the culture of the Pale, which is a little more orderly. They don't allow organized thievery, it's not the kind of wild or maybe unlawful a place. Although the towns with thieves' guilds seem to be like lawful neutral evil and game alignment, and I would guess the Pale would be much more. Limiting on this wildness. Now, we also have that Gord and his fellows are also bandits. I mean, when they're just out and out robbing people on the road, merchants and tradesmen. And then now Gord has added to what he had did in thievery, that he has now learned this acrobatics. So they're now acting more like cat burglars than with him and the two René companions here, that they are acting as cat burglars rather than just their normal cons and swindles kind of thing. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 125, paragraph 4. Blending of the races here, Aridian and Flan, with a bit of blonde soul cropping up here and there, made the Palish a robust and handsome folk, although their bent was such that they tended toward propriety and soberness, tenaciously adhered to the teachings of Foltus. The Palish did have their moments of levity and celebration, too. They were intelligent, industrious, and tough. All told, Gord found them interesting, if a bit dull, but they were also quite prosperous and tended to be easy marks, for there were few thieves among them. Stealing was punishable by death. Then again, so were most other honorable pastimes, such as seduction. Threesome spent a few days in the town of Augberg, city, actually, for it had well over 10,000 inhabitants, although it was an unsophisticated place at best. They then put the peak... They then put the peaks of the Rakers behind them and rode north and west along the road to Wintershiven, for their purses were full for the moment. The capital city of the theocracy was too sober a place, however, and from there the three had traveled southward again, ending up in Redmond. There Gord and his two companions settled down for rest, relaxation, and whatever revelry they could find. Despite the veil of devoted service they wore, the local populace was ready enough for surreptitious activities of the frivolous and licentious sort, as the small but active body district soon demonstrated to the newcomers. Wild young men with silver to spend were welcome indeed, and soon the three of them were minor celebrities. The lionization did go to their heads a bit, Gord admitted to himself in reflection, so that they became incautious in their talk. While they did not actually tell anyone that they planned to rob the temple, they did plenty of bragging about how rich they soon would be. What transpired after they broke into the strong room of the place and made off with the treasury that the canon had so rigorously extorted from the faithful was not surprising, reflected Gord, considering their carelessness. Beautiful light had been the key to the success of the heist, of course, and Gord thought that her fury at being left behind when they made off with the loot was probably the major spur to the pursuit, which even now continued. He had promised to take the canon's daughter along when they left Redmond, and so she had told Gord all about the location of the treasure and about the magical protections that warded the amassed contributions, which, once pilfered, would enable them to journey elsewhere in high style. How could she really have thought that three hard-riding thieves could carry along a soft female? Her presence would have made their capture certain within a day or two, for someone other than she could have described the trio to the angry canon and his men-at-arms. And they would be as conspicuous as could be if they tried to travel with a female. Gord was certain that Light had described him as completely as anyone could have, and that spurred him on. He had no means of disguise at hand, so his only recourse was to get clear of the Pale as rapidly as possible. This he had been seeking to do for days now, but the cursed soldiers trailing him made it difficult indeed. The three had split up as soon as they discovered that a company of horsemen was in hot pursuit. All that resulted from this move was a division of the troop following into three separate squadrons. Each group was a dozen or more strong, and each man was equipped with lance, crossbow, and shield. Gord never considered an attempt to thin their numbers by ambush, for what chance did he have against such soldiers? Certainly a well-spun bullet from his sling might have some effect, but retributive missiles and close pursuit would make such attack the height of folly. Evading them and outdistancing them were utmost in Gord's mind. Evidently his pursuers desired quite the opposite. Break. All right. Now, again, we have a little bit of travelogue here, and we have Gord moving through the Pale. Now, he's describing some business with the Pale. He describes the town of Augsburg as a city with well over 10,000 inhabitants. But again, most of these places are too dull for the likes of Gord. There's no organized thieves' guild. So that what loot they get would probably have to be kept as loot rather than fenced off for gold if there's not really much organization and the Pale is punishing thievery by death. Now, we hear that Winterschiven is the capital of the theocracy, and we learn that even the smaller town of Redmond has a more bawdy district. Now, that would kind of suggest then that even though they're harsh in some ways, especially against thievery, that they still have, and I would imagine Winterschiven, unless there is even more of a kind of Puritan streak. Now, much of what's described by the belief system and the worship of Foltis, that seems to be almost like it seems very similar to me to be kind of like English Puritanism. And I get that feel that the described context is supposed to kind of reflect that. But although there might be more toward a monotheistic belief system in the Pale with Foltis, but what I think it could also be is that, again, it might be one of these polytheistic, but most people only follow Foltis rather than looking at, the various deities. Now, back in the city of Greyhawk, not only were deities, cultural deities of Oridian or Sul or Flan mentioned, but the common person actually is mentioning Istus, who's the Baclunish deity. And so Greyhawk seems to be much more cosmopolitan. And in there, it seems like there's the high priest of Zilchus was mentioned. And it seems like there, and it mentioned numerous temples and cathedrals. So the city of Greyhawk seems to reflect the belief system of not only a polytheism, but where even deities from other, other lands, other cultures, that they're all more commonplace and known, at least a few of them, like Istus. Ralashaz was mentioned.
A couple of temples, even in the slums, to different gods.
Yeah, I don't remember them being in the slums.
Well, it might be from the box set map, but
because one of the things that struck me about the slums was that they were such a horrible area that it struck me that the good deities should have shrines and temples and things to try to help out the people in the slums, and there was no mention of that. So I don't believe I've read any mention so far in the book about the city having temples in the slums. But now we're off to this Winterschiven, and it does seem to me that they're not trying to actually follow like the Pilgrim Puritans, like the Cromwellian Puritan movement, but they're describing that there is this sobriety worker thing, but at the same time, their morals are definitely not there. Either that it's an open, bit of hypocrisy that they have these body districts, and it does imply that they extort from the faithful these prizes and treasures. So there is, they do look at the Pale is being described in a very negative way, and also more like a monotheistic society, and that is not being put out as a positive. And from somebody from Gord's point of view, who's used to all these different all these different deities being there, then you could see where that would really maybe strike him, maybe even by surprise. With the first exposure to a group that really only follows one deity. And it's hard to tell how they follow Foltis in the city of Greyhawk.
Yeah, I didn't think we heard anything about Foltis and Greyhawk.
No, and here he's being his worshippers, not necessarily Foltis, or but his worshippers in the Pale are being shown that way. Now, I'd written a novel based off of G1, you know, the Steading of the Hill Giant Chief, and one of the characters is a priest of Foltis, and I had written that character as very, you know, very arrogant and bigoted, and you know, he's supposedly serving the good, but he's serving it in what he thinks is good, and so, you know, I picked up that idea that the people from the Pale are very much, you know, at least their religious leaders, like the canon, are very much bigoted. So, you know, here, this again starts to flesh out things. Now, I could see where you wouldn't necessarily agree with the way Foltis is being portrayed, but, you know, it's, again, it's not necessarily the way Foltis is portrayed anywhere but the Pale. You know, you're going to have these derivations in belief systems, even among people worshiping the same deities. So, like, the people of the Pale may follow Foltis in a much different way than, you know, people worshiping Foltis in other areas are.
Right, and it's not necessarily Foltis's fault that his worshippers worship him that way.
In the Pale.
Yeah.
It's also interesting, now, here is the first mention of the Flan, and that the mixture is mainly Iridian Flan with a little Sul. And so we have, if we look at the setting material and we see the migrations, we see that the Pale is one of the areas where, even though the Iridians controlled it, they bred in with the local population, and that the Sul migration really didn't come up, you know, this far. And so, you know, there's only some of that mixture with the Sul, and instead the common, and that would also affect what the language should be like. That common, you know, is this mixture even of Baclunish, but there should be, I think, like it's noted that in either Lukash or Radagast City, that their common was accented, you know. So that the common tongue in the Pale should also be accented. And I think he's traveled a far enough distance and into a much different culture so that it's very likely that the language of the Pale, and maybe even most of the common people, would not be, you know, this trade, you know, common tongue that's spoken. But we see here, again, like I said, this is the first time that in the Pale the Flan are mentioned. So there should be this combination of the Iridian culture and the Flanish culture and that has, you know, perhaps survived. And we can see, like, in there may be a separation of class between Iridian and Flan. Because if you look at England, when the Normans conquered in 1066, the people they conquered were actually Anglo-Saxons, and then when the Normans came, the Anglo-Saxons were then they were pushed out, they were conquered, and they were at the very limit of lesser nobility, while the rulers came in, and even though they had been Northmen, you know, they had been Vikings, they had lived long enough in France so that they spoke French. So that when they came in, those conquerors spoke French as the aristocratic language, and the Anglo-Saxon was the language of the lower class. So we might see, and you might want to use it as an idea to run the Pale, as having, you know, maybe everybody who is the worshippers of Foltis there. I don't remember offhand, is Foltis an Iridian god? Because it may be that the worship of Foltis may mainly be by Iridian culture, and there might be a Flanish culture also included. All right, we're just a minute away from 7, so I think I'm going to wrap it up here for the night. We're ending on page, I believe, 127. There was a little bit more here about the quality of the soldiers. You know, that is speaking something. If Redmond is a small, is a moderate town or such, that around 36 soldiers are sent out to pursue Gordon and the two Rene thieves, and now they're away from that area for over 2 weeks. That is, you know, that for a town would be, you know, that would be sizable. I would say there has to be something about the canon and the worship that maybe Redmond is like those towns that used to be like holy sites, because it just seems like there's that canon is commanding, dozens of soldiers, and maybe he's based there. Maybe there's a temple. So maybe a Redmond may not be a big town in of itself, but maybe it's a important a religious place, maybe with artifacts or, you know, some spot that is considered holy. Because just talking about that many soldiers and mounted soldiers who are able to chase after Gord, that talks about a very sizable, important town. To keep that many people fed, and, you know, to be just soldiers, that is, that's something, because these men are not crafters. They're not adding to anything in the economy. They're only there, if they're soldiers, they're only there for guarding and fighting. And it takes quite a bit to keep those men alive. So, yes, so Foltus is an Aridian god. So I think that if I were going to detail the Pale, I would have the members of the clerics, most of them be Aridian, or mainly Aridian, and if not, you know, like genetically Aridian, then culturally. And I would have the Flan following, you know, their own, the Druidic faiths, or the the other Flanish gods. So I think that really inspires me to do something and flesh out the Pale. Because even though it might be a much more sober place, it doesn't mean that it wouldn't be full of adventure. And things that there might be, like a dungeon or, you know, some place to go and investigate as adventurers. And then when they come back to one of the cities, they find that there's a lot of taxes and controls. And it might be a very adventuresome thing going back and forth.
The Pale seems to be the most different city, nation that we've encountered so far.
Definitely.
Everywhere else.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, really, Lukash and Radagast City are pretty much like lesser Greyhawks. You know, they seem set up, and even Caporna, the biggest thing that seemed different to me was the idea that it had such a major festival for a small city, that it would double in size during that festival. And we're never really told anything about that with, you know, the city of Greyhawk. Now, we are mentioned here, too, then, that Radagast City has its own time of fair, you know, during the spring. And another thing not mentioned, but definitely all the towns in the Pale so far and the whole culture of the Pale, it seems to be much, much different. Whereas Lukash, the County of Ernst, the Duchy of Ernst, both of them seem to be very much in the line of Greyhawk, you know, a little more open, cosmopolitan, and they aren't really, you know, relatively, they're still in within the same area of the city of Greyhawk. So I think that could be, you know, like a strong influence right there, I would probably have it that, like, they ape the fashions. Greyhawk's going to be like New York City. It's the big city. And then these are all lesser places, but, you know, some of them big enough. But, no, I think that this is a really good example here of making sure that you do not cookie-cutter your cultures and your countries in the campaign. I think it's much more fun and enriching to play, where you have definitely a different attitude and culture for every one of these states. Some are similar, but like having something radically different, like the Pale, that isn't an evil country, but is not necessarily what everybody's going to view as good. I really think that's, you know, I think that is essential to making an interesting campaign. Well, it's a little after 7. I'm going to end it here for the night. We're going to have all these things archived. I believe it's recordings 1 to 16 are archived. So look forward to this recording being archived. If anyone wants to comment, please check out the Greyhawk fiction text and check out the archives. Where you can start a topic in the general Greyhawk section of the Cannonfire website. You can bring things up here to talk about. But right here, if you don't want to talk but you want to ask questions, please feel free to just write out a comment, and you know, so that, you know, we can because it really makes this such a better commentary. For these questions to be brought out as it's going along. And that is going to be it for me for tonight.